You're listening to Drop the Mic with me, Jason Hunt, and in today's episode, we're joined by Charles Float, a guru in the world of SEO and digital strategy. Known for his cutting-edge techniques and pioneering approaches, Charles has helped shape the landscape of online marketing with his forward-thinking insights. Known for his ability to decode Google's algorithms, Charles will share his strategies for staying ahead in the ever-evolving SEO game, his predictions for the future of online marketing, and how businesses can leverage organic search to skyrocket their growth. And yes, we will touch on AI and SEO in this episode. Without further ado, let's kick it to my chat with Charles Float.
Charles, what is going on?
Not much, just finishing a very long day yet again. Recently, feeling like a lot of long days recently, to be fair. But I guess it's with everything that's going on in the world, it feels good to be useful.
Yeah, definitely. And you're based in Chiang Mai, where you guys incur the odd windstorm and probably power outage and such.
Yeah, so I moved from Chiang Mai last year, but I live in Thailand still. I live in Koh Samui, so I live in the islands.
Nice. Yeah. I love Koh Samui. Yeah. I actually been to Koh Samui twice, and I was on a trip to Koh Phangan. So
yeah. I live 5 minutes from the harbor, so we could go. Nice. Go to Koh Phangan in half an hour.
That's awesome. So have you been to the full moon and half moon parties?
Yep, unfortunately. Yes.
Which do you prefer, the full moon or the half moon parties?
There's actually a secret party that nobody knows about, right? And it's called the Eden party. And it's normally around the same time as full moon. So it's not the same time as half moon. It's normally the same time as full moon. And when you're on Koh Phangan, you have to take a little boat, another boat, to get to this other little island, which is attached to Koh Phangan. It's like another island, but like they're like attached under the water. And it's got, it's wild. It's like a really, really cool party and stuff. And it's, yeah, but nobody knows about it. And it's very
Dutch. You have to live. You have to live on Koh Samui for a period of time before you know about that island, I feel like.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's a secret.
So, funny, because I remember the full moon party, it was okay. It was just like, it was way overhyped. I found being at Hadrian Beach there like a couple days before the full moon party was the best experience, right? It's just like the ocean's like a toilet bowl of people pissing and puking and during the full moon party. It wasn't that great. At least that was my experience.
Yeah, it's very commercialized and stuff. And now it's a bit crazy. So there's people, obviously it's a tiny little beachfront, right? And now you've got like these really rich people from like China and Russia and Israel and stuff that are coming in, and they like drive in with Rolls Royces to the party. Yeah. And you're like, why is there like six Rolls Royces coming down this Thai narrow street? Why didn't you just walk from the top of the hill? It takes 20 minutes to drive a mile an hour down this tiny little narrow street in your like $500,000 Rolls Royce. Or you could just walk in 30 seconds. So it's really quite ridiculous. And it's like I said, it's just too busy. There's just too many people now. And it's gotten overwhelmed and things. And it's not that much fun as it used to be.
Hence why you're maybe leaving Koh Samui and taking yourself over to Europe. That's the plan?
Yep. So yeah, moving back to Europe. So going to Cyprus, hopefully in June or August next year. We're still debating on which month officially to move. But yeah, getting out of Thailand, it's just, I've been here for 6 years, it'll be 7 years next year. And it's been a long time. I'm only 27, right? That's a long time for somebody my age. And I need to go over to Europe to be closer to clients, to be able to fly to more events, to be able to fly to the States and Canada to see you guys and to meet up with a lot of clients, do consultations on the ground because you get paid more in person than you do online. And I've been working towards trying to build more with partnerships in Europe and America because there's not as many opportunities in Asia, unfortunately.
How important is it for you to have those physical relationships where you're actually meeting in person? Because like you said, being in Thailand, you're kind of limited. There's a lot of SEOs in Thailand, right? So I'm sure you're rubbing shoulders with them. But in terms from a business standpoint and moving businesses forward, how important is it to have that face-to-face meeting on a regular basis?
Yeah, 100%. So it would depend on the business and stuff, right? So there's certain partnerships and certain opportunities that you're only going to be able to meet in person, right? And even when it comes to knowledge and sharing information and knowing really about people, if you meet in person at events and at conferences even if you just go on like retreats and stuff like that and meet up in for coffees and things, people are a lot more willing to share person to person than they are account to account kind of thing. So you end up at conferences picking up all of these little golden nuggets and things that you would have never caught online just because people are so wary about sharing things online that they are not in person, especially if they've had a couple of drinks at the bar, being a bit loud kind of thing. You get a lot of golden nuggets out of those little meetings.
I used to be more of a smoker. I don't smoke as much anymore. But the only time I will actually have a cigarette is probably when I'm at a conference, because I've probably done more business at a conference in the smoking section than inside of the bar.
Yeah, exactly. The bar is full of loud personalities. The smoking area is full of relaxed, calm people ready to make decisions, right? It's also different approaches, right? You find different personalities at the bar versus in the smoking area, for sure.
I just find it so much easier to ask somebody for a lighter than ask them if they want a drink.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
that makes sense.
And now for yourself, you've ingrained yourself into the event marketing space, right? You have your events around the globe. Tell me a bit about those events and what got you down that path of being an event organizer.
Yeah. So I was running my own conferences around the world. I had one in Birmingham in the UK, which is not the destination that most people would think of, but that's where I'm from. And I also had one in Phuket. We've just done one in Dubai. We've done a couple others internationally, one in like a meetup in Canada, some meetups in Mexico, other places around the world and things. But in terms of conferences, I started running them because in the SEO industry, the conference space is very controlled by the kind of white hat side of the community, right? And it means that at those conferences, they censor people, to be honest, right? You can't come on stage and talk about certain topics at a lot of the SEO conferences, especially the biggest ones. Because number one, a lot of those conferences invite Google, so they don't want to be seen promoting X, Y, and Z that's against Google when they've literally got the same Google engineers in the room, which I understand, but I also don't really know why you're inviting the company that you're trying to manipulate into the room in the first place. And then the second part was I felt that it had also, I don't want to get too political, but people were afraid of saying certain things at events. And I felt that that kind of an atmosphere was detrimental to the future of our industry. So I wanted to create something and create a safe space, right, where people can share whatever they want to. They can talk about whatever they like to, and they're not going to be judged about it. And they're not going to be asked to leave the room or to be silent, right? I'm not going to suppress people. I'm not going to censor people. I'm going to let people show what is working, why it's working, and how it's working. And those events started going really well. The only issue we ran into was that event management and organization is a lot of work. Like, it is a killer amount of work, especially if you have got no experience in doing it beforehand. You've got a checklist the size of a CVS receipt kind of thing coming at you. So I was just wanting to pack in those conferences and put them in the bin because I was done with the amount of stress and people messaging you and pressuring you and people trying to talk, but they don't want to come and like all of this kind of stuff, right? And eventually I spoke with White Press, who I'm a business partners with. So I'm an ambassador for them. I do some consultancy with them, do a lot of work with White Press. And they said, hey, look, you stress out at these events all the time, right? And we sponsor your events all the time, and we always get business out of them. So why don't we just run the events for you, and you can be the host, and all of that stress and organizational worry goes out the window. You just need to show up and deliver, and we'll put your name on it, and people are going to come anyway, right? So I basically handed over my entire conference business to White Press on the grounds that we'd go into a partnership 50-50, and we just ran our first event, which was in Dubai in February, and we had a sellout event, 102 tickets. It was $1,900 a ticket, and we had five sponsors. All the sponsors sold out. We had a super yacht that we had the opening party on. We had the number one trending hotel in Dubai. We had some amazing speakers from around the AI world. We had CMOs coming and attending from Microsoft, from Alibaba, from Binance, from massive companies, and it felt like that event really kicked off where we're going to be moving forward. And it really was a very high level event. Whereas in comparison to a lot of SEO events nowadays, half the room is just interns because it's a lot of these conferences are just trying to give away tickets to pack a room for pictures and photos rather than actually pack a room full of experience and innovation, right?
Very interesting. And it's interesting how the mainstream shows they frown upon certain topics that are being discussed because Google is listening, literally. They're there at the event, of course, right? It makes total sense. But you, it sounds in the Black Hat world, you've carved out this niche for conferences, and there's obviously a need for it. Putting a premium ticket price on it is fantastic, and people that are paying that premium price probably still think you're undercharging, right?
Yep.
Because there's so much value in it, right? 102 people, it's intimate, it's small. When you decided to go into that space of event marketing or event management, how did you fit that into your schedule? Because you're already busy. You have this new endeavor that's super exciting. And how do you put all the pieces together? Because at first, you can't just come up with an idea and just delegate. You have to somewhat be involved at the beginning stages of it before you actually hand it off. Explain how that whole process worked.
Yeah. So my team will probably say I'm the best and worst person to work for in the world, right? Because I like creating projects with fine deadlines, right? So I'm like, look, guys, I've got this idea. We're launching tomorrow, right? Because nothing's ready, but we're going to launch tomorrow. And they're like, okay, here we go. Ready for another 24-hour work session kind of thing. But obviously, they're fantastically looked after. We sort them out. Healthcare, everything is sorted. They have no worries or stresses, really. But when I first wanted to do the events, I told my team, look, I think we should run an event, because an event recently that was in the UK that was organized for Black Hats had been canceled. So it was basically the only event left that was for Black Hats. Now there have been a couple more spawn up since, but at the time it felt like that was the nail in the coffin of Black Hat SEO conferences. So I told my team, look, our agency, which was a link agency at the time, I ended up selling it to a fund that is now public on the NASDAQ. Yeah, and I sold that company. But at the time, it was going really well. And I had this team and we had this office in the UK already. And I was like, look, let's just host an event. We have the audience, we have the customer base, we have the numbers, we have all of these people that we were looking forward to going to this event. So we can just transition them. And we're in the Facebook groups for the event already. We have the email lists and they're like CCing people. It's not even BCC, right? We just copy their emails. There's all of these things, right? That we can just pull in basically their audience and throw it into our event. And we charged the tickets like $100 a ticket. VIP was like $250 or something. We tried to get a really nice hotel. We got like the Hyatt Regency 5-star hotel, the nicest hotel in our city and things like that. We tried to go all out and deliver something of value. And people felt like it was really well put together. And I was pretty amazed because we did it all in 33 days. So from the day I came up with the idea to the day the event went live was 33 days. And I gave my team, wow, you know, that time to find a venue, put everything together. We didn't have sponsors. I said, look, I'll fund the whole thing because at this point, there's no point really in trying to secure sponsors and things. And we have no premise or any idea of how many tickets we're going to sell or anything. And that was the initial kickoff for me, really, was that first event. But it was just that testing things. And I'm always a big proponent of that anyway in business. And this is why I like having my team that can just instantly react to my ideas. Because if we can throw something into the real world, we can see if it's a valid idea. We can see if it's a valid product. And most people's teams are too slow or too inefficient to be able to launch stuff immediately. And I'm talking like my developer will stay on from 3 p.m. till 3 a.m. making sure the code is right. And my copywriter will do everything perfectly. But most people don't have the execution ability. And it has allowed me to just launch and launch and see what works, see what sticks, and have that approach of throwing stuff at the wall, seeing what sticks, and then just building off of that. And it's really worked quite well for me. And that's how I came up with the idea of conferences and how I've since expanded to them as well.
From inception to sold out conference in 33 days. That sounds like the makings of a new course.
Yeah. Though my the CEO of my company, he's now the CEO, he's the manager at the time. He will definitely say he would not recommend you buy that course.
Fair. Okay. In terms of, you mentioned execution, right? That, I think that's the biggest thing. Like entrepreneurs like yourselves are coming up with ideas all the time. At our office here, we're in the boardroom on the whiteboard, like military style, coming up with new ideas all the time. The biggest hurdle is just the execution aspect of it and finding people that can actually execute for you and be reliable to fulfill execution. What's your process like for finding executors?
Yeah, so I have a very small team. So actually, weirdly enough, last month, so it's March right now, so last month in February, I launched a SEO recruitment agency. So we now actually have our own like candidate database, and I can pull in from other clients' campaigns where he said, actually, this candidate was really good, but it wasn't a fit for this job. Maybe I can pull him into to my position. But over time, I've tried to keep my team very small, but always just kept an eye out for talent, basically. And I've just slowly gathered this collection of people over time that are very skilled at what they do. So I have, so the CEO of my company, he's still the designer because he's just too good at design that we can't find anybody that is better than him in the speed that he does it. And also bear in mind, he's now working on AI image generation models and all sorts of mental stuff as well, way beyond what I ever initially hired him for and things, right? And then I met my copywriter, because he was the head editor for another SEO tool. They went bankrupt, but I really liked their blog. And I was like, hey, how much are they paying you? I'll give you an extra $500 a month. Come work for me. And he's worked for me ever since. He was based in the Philippines, but we pay him US salaries, essentially. And then I met our developer off Upwork. I was just trialing people off Upwork for developers. And he passed our challenge, the fastest, best, and most capable. And then we just started using him forever. And now we've used him for basically everything. And he's our head of engineering. And he's on a decent US salary. And he's based in India. So,
with the emergence of AI, what kind of an impact has that had on your talent pool or your workforce? Have you reduced the amount of people that are working for you by having AI replace them? Or are they using AI as a superpower? How does that shake down for your employees?
Yeah, so my top level guys, they've all gone from this much ability to this much ability, right? Like they have scaled beyond anything. Like my designer is a perfect example. He used to be able to make a YouTube thumbnail. And bear in mind, he does CRO, consumer psychology based thumbnails for YouTube. So it's high CTR thumbnails, 15% CTR in some videos and things, right? He used to be able to make one or two of them a day because of the amount of time and resources and everything. He'd be like custom editing a dragon in the background and things like that. So it would be a lot of work. Nowadays, it's just AI. And the thing that a lot of people don't realize when they're generating AI images is something that he's taught me, which is, again, this is the other thing. Listen to your employees. Right. If you've hired someone who's really good at design, chances are they know things about design that you don't. So I spoke to them. I was like, hey, how are you doing this? Because your images look so much better than mine when they're outputting. And he's like, oh, that's not Midjourney. And I was like, how did you generate it then? He was like, oh, no, I use Midjourney first. And then I use Photoshop generative fill inside of Photoshop to edit pieces of the image that he didn't like. Right. Mm. So there was like maybe this bit of text was off, but the rest of the image is perfect. He'd use generative fill to remove that bit of text, but it would be perfectly edited because of how Photoshop works. Right? And I haven't seen anybody doing that. And he's been doing that since Midjourney came out last year. So stuff like that has been able to improve my understanding of AI just by speaking to my guys about how they're using it. And then as a team, we've been collaborating to try and create better uses. But then in terms of the lower level people, basically, they're all gone. It's really bad to say, but we've got rid of a lot of our VAs because we don't need them anymore. A lot of our copywriters, we don't have any copywriters anymore apart from the one main guy who does sales level copy and VSL level copy and stuff, right? And scripts and checklists and downloads and lead magnets and things. Then we don't have any of our keyword research VAs anymore. We don't have anyone who's doing like clustering and things anymore because we just use automated tools and things. A lot of those lower level tasks, they're just gone now completely. And we don't pay anybody to do them anymore because we found a tool or a process that is just completely automated that workflow.
It's interesting. A lot of our copywriters are no longer copywriters. They're more editors. They're editors of content. But what you just said about that whole Midjourney example, that's essentially the way people should be leveraging ChatGPT now, right? It's just don't take it for what it spits out to you, but refining it, making it better. And maybe you could talk about some of the ways that in your processes for SEO, how are you best leveraging AI?
Yeah, so it's across the board. We're using it for so many different things. The main thing for SEO, I'd say the best leverage case is digital PR, right? So we used to be creating these hugely complicated, very long-winded processes for creating just the ideas for digital PR. If you think about, we've done a lot of stuff like gambling. So anytime the Grand National in the UK, which is like the biggest horse race in the world, anytime that comes on, it's a very good digital PR piece to be able to jump on because you can talk about jockeys, you can talk about horses, you can talk about statistics, you can talk about facts, history, all of these things. And journalists like picking it up and use and referencing it in their writings about certain things. Or you can create statistics from here and correlate them with things like that. All of that stuff is now basically automated to the point where we don't even ideate in the first place, right? So a lot of the time now, what we do is we just get the niche, like gambling or anything that we do, a lot of tech and financial niches and things like that. We get that niche and then we find trending topics. So we'll find trending topics via Brian Dean's Exploding Topics. We'll get AI to ideate the two together and just come up with ideas. 50, 60, 90% are going to be trash, right? But you'll find 1, 2, 3 ideas, which are gold. And that used to take a human a full day or a full week of just brainstorming ideas to come up with how you can combine two niches. And in before even, it would go finding those trending topics was hard. And now Brian Dean uses AI to find them, so it makes it a lot easier, right? So we're using AI layered on AI to improve processes and efficiencies, which used to be massively manual. A lot of the time, though, it's stuff like digital PR, keyword research and intent and clustering, and then content generation, and then, you know, bulk pages and things like that. A lot of the time and costs have just been soaked up by AI now. You know, it used to cost you $100 to get an article written. It now costs 40 cents to cover, right?
This episode is brought to you by Cuppa. Are you spending a lot of time optimizing the content for your website? Wait no more. Build optimized content in minutes. You can start driving traffic to your site in less time than it takes to brew your morning coffee. Over 1 million articles have been generated with a 95% satisfaction rate. Cuppa is trusted by builders, agencies, and content teams across the globe. Start your free trial today. Go to cuppa.sh. That's cuppa.sh. Use the code SAVE50 to receive a $50 credit.
You mentioned Cuppa. Maybe Cuppa, people that are listening to this podcast will know Cuppa is the main sponsor of the podcast, but full transparency, myself and Charles work very closely with Cuppa. As partners with Cuppa. Maybe Charles, you can give our audience a high level understanding on how Cuppa works and what it is.
Yeah, so a lot of people in SEO and even outside of SEO, just in digital marketing and especially in agency life in general, have been using AI content, ChatGPT, to write content for their social posts or their blog posts or, you know, even like money pages, like product pages and things like that, product descriptions, all sorts of things. The problem is ChatGPT raw out the box is pretty bad, right? It's detectable, it has patterns, it's recognizable, it's not very good at writing at human level, it's not very interesting, there's lots of problems with tone and engagement and repetition and all sorts of things, right? And then you even have things like false positives and negatives and all sorts of stuff which end up breaking it even more. With Cuppa, what we did was we took the API from OpenAI and we started adding things on top of it. So instead of just having one prompt generating your content, we used sequencing. So you do multiple sequencing to generate different parts of the article at different times. And then you add in, for example, instead of generating the introduction first, we create the article and then we write the introduction at the end as a concise rewrite of the entire article, basically, right? So you're not creating an introduction before you create the piece of content, because again, that doesn't really work in the real world. And most people will write the intro and the conclusion after they've written the main piece of content. And we do the same thing, again, humanizing ChatGPT, essentially. Then we also have things like vectorization, which is really nerdy, but essentially all it means is that we turn keywords and words that ChatGPT repeatedly uses, and we try and make them more random or more human-like. And we try and
like use delve, exactly. Elevate, walk,
realm.
Yeah.
All of these things, right? We try and make sure that those words are being used and that human words are being used. So it's a natural language processing algorithm. And then finally, we use sequencing, layering, and then finally, we also use additional tactics as well, which is called RAG, or Retrieval Augmented Generation, which is where we'll find the top 20 pages that are ranking for your keyword. We'll analyze the content in them, and then we'll use that content analysis in our creation of the content as well.
So what problem is it best serving for SEO's Cuppa? What's the pain point that it's really addressing at its core from a very high level?
Yeah, it's a content generation suite. So the main thing that people struggle with in SEO is the content initially. If you imagine Amazon right now has literally got like a trillion words on its website, that's quite a scary thought of someone having to create a trillion words to compete with Amazon. But when you use AI in the mix, that trillion words is actually a lot less of amount of time to go and create. It's not a lifetime amount of work anymore.
And I think that's for a lot of our listeners out there that might not be SEOs. They can still benefit from a platform like Kappa. They can definitely, if you're creating any sort of a blog or any sort of an affiliate website, you're definitely going to benefit from a platform like Kappa. What are some of the best success stories that you've seen thus far, Charles, and maybe a success story that you've had yourself with Kappa?
Yeah, so in general, the best I personally had is using free parasite pages. So parasite SEO is a whole avenue we could go down because it's very technical and high level stuff. But essentially, Google favors websites with more authority, more trust, and more links and things than other websites. The BBC, slightly more trusted by Google than like a little mommy blog or something like that. So you can abuse that trust and authority in Google by creating pages on websites that allow you to buy those pages or build those pages. So it might be building like a Medium, or it might be buying them on like a local newspaper website. I use Kappa to create as many posts that are optimized for that keyword as possible, and then post them on the free parasite pages, and just again throwing at a wall and seeing what sticks, and just trying to see which pages we can rank. But Kappa has allowed me to create those pages in an hour. It used to be I have to create a sheet of the content, then I have to tell the writers what word count I have to, then I have to make sure it's edited, then I have to make sure it's copies get passed, then I have to make sure it's not stolen the website, plagiarized, all of these things, right? I don't have to do any of that anymore because I know that out of the box, this content is going to be good enough to rank.
Where is this all going? Like right now, this is how it's working for us today. Where do you see all of this trending and going in the next 6 months, a year? What are we going to be doing in a year's time?
It's very difficult to say because like if you take Sora as an example, right? Most people's idea of AI video generation was very basic until Sora came out, and then everyone lost their minds. I think the exact same thing is going to happen over and over again, unfortunately. People aren't going to expect these things to happen because it's so sci-fi-esque, we're going to see more rapid advancements, and it's going to affect industries and technologies that people didn't expect it to affect. And because, again, it's fairly hard to predict these technologies and things without being in the midst of them, because we only know so much based on releases, right? So our understanding is based on the current releases and current news cycle of the technology. But the technology news cycle is very different to where the technology actually is. And these journalists don't fully have an understanding of any of the technologies at all. So it means that a lot of people's understanding is quite warped from where we're actually progressing towards. So I would always recommend, if you can, read journals and read papers and read research papers. And again, people are, oh, I've got to go read a 96-page research paper from Princeton. No, you use Claude to summarize it, right? Use AI to summarize the research papers, and then you read the 10 bullet points and you're done. And you do the same thing over and over again. And eventually you come up with this very, very solid understanding of where the technology and the future is moving towards.
Being so embedded as an entrepreneur in the SEO space, I think it's your natural habitat to just expect change and expect the need to adapt to change. And that's also why it probably makes it so difficult to predict the future, because it is difficult to even try to guess what the future holds, because it always changes and throws you curveballs, right? So it's more like, hey, let's just get ready for it. Get ready to adapt. Inevitably, things are not going to be the way they are today. They're going to change, and it's just a matter of time before that happens.
Yeah, and in SEO, a lot of the industry is just used to getting wrecked by Google. So we're used to our businesses being burned to the ground overnight and restarting from the ashes, right? So it's not this. A lot of the SEO mindset is used to this, the way AI is changing the world. And so we're not as aghast at how the world is changing so rapidly, because we're used to the world being set on fire overnight and us having to put out the flames every so often.
Some people have been quoted by saying that SEO is dead. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's nonsense, right? So a lot of people, again, people conflate SEO with Google optimization, right? Search engine optimization does not mean Google optimization, right? Search engines, there's a lot of different search engines outside of Google, right? Turns out Amazon search engine is massively increasing every year, but with different users, especially in the US, searching for products on Amazon. If you can, if you're an SEO that can rank on Amazon's algorithm, is the A10 algorithm, by the way, currently, and you can rank on that algorithm consistently and you know how to manipulate it, it is manipulation, unfortunately, and especially with Amazon, then you can get paid ridiculous amounts of money. You can imagine if you can rank number one for elliptical or treadmill on Amazon in the US, how much money that's going to generate in terms of sales, right? You can probably sell 1,000 units a day of treadmills or ellipticals, which is mind-boggling amounts of money. So I think that when people say SEO is dead, most of them are conflating it with Google. And even then, when you actually look into Google as a business whole, yes, they have lost search traffic in specific regions and niches. So for example, makeup tutorials are now searched more on YouTube and TikTok than they are on Google, obviously, right? There's certain things like travel, and there's all these kind of niches which have slowly been taken away by other search engines. But again, it's other search engines taking the traffic, not Google losing it to another platform or something, right? And then even with SEO, you can theoretically say that you can manipulate ChatGPT as an output. If you can manipulate the sources that ChatGPT is pulling from, right? And that is technically a form of SEO in the first place.
That was my next question. And how can you manipulate OpenAI's content that's being fed to ChatGPT? Is there a way that you can go about navigating that, or is it too premature?
You can't. So we've done it actually already. So the way that you have to go about it is reverse engineering source context. So a lot of the time, you have to just literally niche down and start asking very specific questions about topics or people. People's a good area where you know the model's going to have limited information on. And you can't let the model use Bing browsing and things like that. You have to say specifically, don't access the internet. Do not use Bing browsing. Only tell me what's within your current model understanding and training data, right? April 2023 for ChatGPT. Once you've got those specific pieces of information, you can very easily then reverse engineer where those pieces of information came from. So you can find out, oh, it's saying that this guy was born on this date of date, but that date of where his birth is only on this one page of the internet, right? So we can know that ChatGPT and OpenAI are probably scraping that website to get that information. If we go and create a page on it, the next time the training data is updated, it should be pulling in our page into its training data as well. So that's what we were doing in late 2022, was just trying to create as much information on certain topics that we knew. A lot of it, also bear in mind, a lot of what we were doing was seeding incorrect information. So we were trying to get ChatGPT to output things that we knew were incorrect, but it wouldn't actually affect. We weren't trying to get it to affect anything in the real world. We were just trying to get it to affect very small, controllable experiments. And we got it to output certain things that we knew were incorrect about the world, but that it had taken from our sources as context. And it only just repurposed that context, right? It doesn't actually fact or verify check or anything like that, because it can't. It's impossible to do.
That's the question. How does ChatGPT verify whether or not the content that's being fed is correct or factual?
Yeah. So the verification system, in my opinion, would be a prioritization of sourcing, right? So you prioritize like university research papers over a Wikipedia page, or you prioritize certain elements over certain other elements. So it'd be quite obvious. You probably would have prioritized Reddit data at the number one top. And there's also some pretty interesting research into using British data, because Brits are so sarcastic that it messes with the AI. Did you know this? So when you use British like training materials, and especially any user generated content, it routinely messes up and says the opposite, because a British person had created a condescending or a play on words kind of thing, and it just completely took it out of context. And because again, it doesn't understand that context, right? It doesn't understand sarcasm and humor and things as we do. And unfortunately, the 20% of what British people say is sarcasm or something. It's like, so it ends up really actually messing with the AI when it used that research data.
You're definitely pleading a case on the need for humans in integrating AI into everyday operation, right? We still need humans.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
It's only a matter of time, though, before probably that is I don't know. I actually don't know if we're always going to need humans as a part of the equation. Really, a lot of the new tools that are being generated and there's so much emphasis or need required on OpenAI. But is there somebody that's coming up that's going to potentially take Bard? Is somebody going to take over OpenAI eventually? Something is inevitably going to happen here.
So all of this technology is all Google, right? Like transformers, LLMs, everything is all Google's technology. It's literally patented open source by Google. The problem is that Google's internal leadership saw that technology as a threat to its search profitability. Bear in mind that something like 95% of Google's profits come from its search ad business. So it needs to hold on to that money, otherwise it dies, right? And most of its internal leadership saw LLMs and saw models and this kind of text generation as a massive threat to search, obviously. So they ended up either conscientiously or subconsciously removing those people from the company. And bear in mind, if you go and look up all of the original research papers on transformers from Google and all of the original research papers on AI and LLMs from 2016, 2015, 2014, none of those people work at Google anymore. None of them, right? They've all gone on to set up Anthropic, Character.ai, Captive.ai, right? There's all of these other tools that are now absolutely killing it, bear in mind. Like a lot of these tools are multi-billion dollar startups and things that were founded by the Google's original AI team. And those people, again, they've all left. So I don't see how Google necessarily claws its way back when it's got this kind of Frankenstein-esque AI, right? So it's had all of these people over the years work on it and contribute to it. And now all those people who have contributed to it, who know what they contributed and know the history of that product, have gone. And so it's these people who are just trying to do surgery on a body that they have, an alien body that they have no idea really about. So it creates these outputs which are damaging to the company and that they've done repeatedly. So they've done these releases which are fakes, or they're using different information, or they're using video editing to show products that aren't real and things. And that's really damaging, just to play catch up, right? It's not even like they're trying to outshine OpenAI. They're just trying to play catch up to them with their own technology, and they're still failing at that. And then we can talk about the whole image wokeness and AI talk. We can't talk about white people and things. That's fucking insane. But that's also a kind of symptom of their politicalness internally. Whereas you can see it with Microsoft's side, they have let the politics go out the window and they're just 100% focused on the product and on the services. And also, I think Microsoft have got slightly a bit more control because every government on the planet still uses Windows. and so they need to phone Microsoft every so often to come and fix their computers. So maybe that does give them a little bit more leeway. But in general, Microsoft are just winning this war. And I don't even necessarily think it's OpenAI that are going to be the future. I think it will be Microsoft because they've consolidated power with inside of OpenAI even, so that even any glimpses of AGI, which in reference to that paper, if you know that paper, will be pushed and moved out of the OpenAI nonprofit and straight into the profitability center of Microsoft. And that's what I think will happen, because that AGI just changes the world. As soon as AGI is released, every industry overnight will be affected, because and especially when it's commercially available, right? If one company has one very expensive AGI machine model that costs $1 million a minute to run or something, that's not necessarily that big of a threat unless it's a bad player using it to hack every bank on the planet or something. But until that kind of moment, that company then controls market share of every other market on the planet, which is very scary and dystopian to think about. And let's hope that they are the good guys. But I do genuinely think that Microsoft are just winning that race and that Google are too far behind and that they're too caught up in internal politics and internal procedures that they're not actually focusing on AGI in the future. They're getting caught up in just trying to play cat and mouse with OpenAI.
That was one of the conflicting themes with the whole Sam Altman going back and forth from Microsoft back to OpenAI. It was the point of how quickly do you release the beast to the public, and whether or not you should control the iterations that are released out there. What are your thoughts on that? Should they just open up the floodgates, or should they put limitations on it?
Yeah, I definitely think you need alignment. You need it to align with human interests and things, right? You can't just let something that might be damaging, might be negative, might be conscientious, and might see us as a threat into the real world. Because as soon as it is within the real world systems, you lose track of it, right? You can't control borders. You can't control servers. You can't control all these different countries and powers and things and stuff. As soon as it gets online, it's gone, right? It's somewhere. It will be, even if it's not ready, it will be lurking and hiding and collecting enough data and building enough power and compute to be one day valuable. But that's the issue. You have to keep everything in a locked room, locked, sealed until you know it's ready. And I think that OpenAI are fairly good gatekeepers of that. But again, with the recent turmoil and Sam Altman saga and things like that, it's shown the weakness in the hinges on the door kind of thing as well.
Charles, this has been awesome. I know you're super busy. You're losing your voice. I appreciate your time. And where you are in the world right now, no worries. It's getting close to sleep time. But how can our audience get in touch with you if they have any questions? And what do you got going on right now if you want people to check out?
Yeah. If I'm not dying, literally, like my throat is...
As long as you don't die, just stay alive.
Yes. Okay. So I am all over the place. Unfortunately, it's the internet. So you can follow me on YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, everything. Just Google my name. I will be there. Hopefully I won't be dying in that instance, but I am right now. It's literally 10 p.m. and I don't know what's going on. My allergies are just playing up to some different degree right now, but Jesus. Yeah, I'm just slowly dying on this podcast, but it's been a great episode.
Yeah, definitely. Good chatting with you. And finally, we've been connected for a while, so I'm glad we had this time to get to meet and chat. But yeah, again, check out Charles on all the socials. He's super active on Twitter. Definitely check him out there. Thanks again, Charles. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Have a good one. I enjoyed it. Peace, guys.
Thank you, podcast listener, for listening to the entire episode with Charles Float. If you got value from that, hey, I know I did. Please go over, give us a subscribe and a rating. Tell your mother, tell your father, tell your son, tell your spouse, tell everybody about that episode if you liked it. And if you want to learn more about Kappa, the platform we discussed in depth on that episode, just go on over to kappa.sh. That's C-U-P-P-A.sh. Until next time, see ya.